Tradition 8. Alcoholics Anonymous should remain forever non-professional, but our service centers may employ special workers. Alcoholics Anonymous will never have a professional class. We have gained some understanding of the ancient words, "Freely ye have received, freely give." We have discovered that at the point of professionalism, money and spirituality do not mix. Almost no recovery from alcoholism has ever been brought about by the world's best professionals, whether medical or religious. We do not decry professionalism in other fields, but we accept the sober fact that it does not work for us. Every time we have tried to professionalize our 12th step, the result has been exactly the same. Our single purpose has been defeated. Alcoholics simply will not listen to a paid 12th stepper. Almost from the beginning, we have been positive that face-to-face work with the alcoholic who suffers could be based only on the desire to help and be helped. When an AA talks for money, whether at a meeting or to a single newcomer, it can have a very bad effect on him, too. The money motive compromises him and everything he says and does for his prospect. This has always been so obvious that only a very few AAs have ever worked the 12-step for a fee. Despite this certainty, it is nevertheless true that few subjects have been the cause of more contention within our fellowship than professionalism. Caretakers who swept floors, cooks who fried hamburgers, secretaries in offices, authors writing books, all these we have seen hotly assailed because they were, as their critics angrily remarked, making money out of AA. Ignoring the fact that these labors were not 12-step jobs at all, the critics attacked as AA professionals these workers of ours who were often doing thankless tasks that no one else could or would do. Even greater furors were provoked when AA members began to run rest homes and farms for alcoholics, when some hired out to corporations as personnel men in charge of the alcoholic problem in industry, when some became nurses on alcoholic wards, when others entered the field of alcohol education. In all these instances and more, it was claimed that AA knowledge and experience were being sold for money. Hence, these people, too, were professionals. At last, however, a plain line of cleavage could be seen between professionalism and non-professionalism. When we had agreed that the 12th step couldn't be sold for money, we had been wise. But when we had declared that our fellowship couldn't hire service workers, nor could any AA member carry our knowledge into other fields, we were taking the counsel of fear. Fear which today has been largely dispelled in the light of experience. Take the case of the club janitor and cook. If a club is going to function, it has to be habitable and hospitable. We tried volunteers who were quickly disenchanted with sweeping floors and brewing coffee 7 days a week. They just didn't show up. Even more important, an empty club couldn't answer its telephone. But it was an open invitation to a drunk on a binge who possessed a spare key. So, somebody had to look after the place full time. If we hired an alcoholic, he'd receive only what we'd have to pay a non-alcoholic for the same job. The job was not to do 12-step work. It was to make 12-step work possible. It was a service proposition, pure and simple. Neither could AA itself function without full-time workers at the foundation and intergroup offices. And here the book has a footnote. It reads, in 1954, the name of the Alcoholic Foundation Incorporated was changed to the General Service Board of Alcoholics Anonymous Incorporated, and the foundation office is now the General Service Office. Returning now to the text, at the foundation and intergroup offices, we couldn't employ non-alcoholics as secretaries. We had to have people who knew the AA pitch. But the minute we hired them, the ultra-conservative and fearful one shrilled professionalism. At one period, the status of these faithful servants was almost unbearable. They weren't asked to speak at AA meetings because they were making money out of AA. At times, they were actually shunned by fellow members. Even the charitably disposed described them as a necessary evil. Committees took full advantage of this attitude to depress their salaries. They could regain some measure of virtue, it was thought, if they worked for AA real cheap. These notions persisted for years. And then we saw... Then we saw that if a hard-working secretary answered the phone dozens of times a day, listened to 20 wailing wives, arranged hospitalization, and got sponsorship for 10 newcomers, and was gently diplomatic with the irate drunk who complained about the job she was doing and how she was overpaid, then such a person could surely not be called a professional AA. She was not professionalizing the 12th step. She was just making it possible. She was helping to give the man coming in the door the break he ought to have. Volunteer committee men and assistants could be of great help, but they could not be expected to carry this load day in and day out. At the foundation, the same story repeats itself. 8 tons of books and literature per month do not package and channel themselves all over the world. Sacks of letters on every conceivable AA problem, ranging from a lonely heart Eskimo to the growing pains of thousands of groups, must be answered by people who know. Right contacts with the world outside have to be maintained. AA's lifelines have to be tended. So we hire AA staff members. We pay them well, and they earn what they get. They are professional secretaries. Here, there is a footnote referring to the professional secretaries of this sentence. It reads, "The work of present-day staff members has no counterpart among the job categories of commercial organizations. These AAs bring a wide range of business and professional experience to their service at GSO." Returning now to the text, "But they certainly are not professional AAs." Perhaps the fear will always lurk in every AA heart that one day our name will be exploited by somebody for real cash. Even the suggestion of such a thing never fails to whip up a hurricane, and we have discovered that hurricanes have a way of mauling with equal severity both the just and the unjust. They are always unreasonable. No individuals have been more buffeted by such emotional gusts than those AAs bold enough to accept employment with outside agencies dealing with the alcohol problem. A university wanted an AA member to educate the public on alcoholism. A corporation wanted a personnel man familiar with the subject. A state drunk farm wanted a manager who could really handle inebriates. A city wanted an experienced social worker who understood what alcohol could do to a family. A state alcohol commission wanted a paid researcher. These are only a few of the jobs which AA members as individuals have been asked to fill. Now and then, AA members have bought farms or rest homes where badly beat up topers could find needed care. The question was, and sometimes still is, are such activities to be branded as professionalism under AA tradition? We think the answer is no. Members who select such full-time careers do not professionalize AA's 12th step. The road to this conclusion was long and rocky. At first, we couldn't see the real issue involved. In former days, the moment an AA hired out to such enterprises, he was immediately tempted to use the name Alcoholics Anonymous for publicity or money-raising purposes. Drunk farms, educational ventures, state legislatures, and commissions advertised the fact that AA members served them. Unthinkingly, AAs so employed recklessly broke anonymity to thump the tub for their pet enterprise. For this reason, some very good causes, and all connected with them, suffered unjust criticism from AA groups. More often than not, these onslaughts were spearheaded by the cry, "Professionalism! That guy is making money out of AA." Yet not a single one of them had been hired to do AA's 12-step work. The violation in these instances was not professionalism at all. It was breaking anonymity. AA's sole purpose was being compromised, and the name of Alcoholics Anonymous was being misused. It is significant, now that almost no AA in our fellowship breaks anonymity at the public level, that nearly all these fears have subsided. We see that we have no right or need to discourage AAs who wish to work as individuals in these wider fields. It would be actually antisocial were we to forbid them. We cannot declare AA such a closed corporation that we keep our knowledge and experience top secret. If an AA member, acting as a citizen, can become a better researcher, educator, personnel officer, then why not? Everybody gains, and we have lost nothing. True, some of the projects to which AAs have attached themselves have been ill-conceived, but that makes not the slightest difference with the principle involved. This is the exciting welder of events which has finally cast up AA's tradition of non-professionalism. Our 12th step is never to be paid for, but those who labor in service for us are worthy of their hire. Tradition 9. AA, as such, ought never be organized, but we may create service boards or committees directly responsible to those they serve. When Tradition 9 was first written, it said that Alcoholics Anonymous needs the least possible organization. In years since then, we have changed our minds about that. Today, we are able to say with assurance that Alcoholics Anonymous, AA as a whole, should never be organized at all. Then, in seeming contradiction, we proceed to create special service boards and committees which in themselves are organized. How then can we have an unorganized movement which can and does create a service organization for itself? Scanning this puzzler, people say, what do they mean, no organization? Well, let's see. Did anyone ever hear of a nation, a church, a political party, even a benevolent association that had no membership rules? Did anyone ever hear of a society which couldn't somehow discipline its members and enforce obedience to necessary rules and regulations? Doesn't nearly every society on earth give authority to some of its members to impose obedience upon the rest and to punish or expel offenders? Therefore, every nation, in fact, every form of society, has to be a government administered by human beings. Power to direct or govern is the essence of organization everywhere. Yet, Alcoholics Anonymous is an exception. It does not conform to this pattern. Neither its General Service Conference, its Foundation Board, and here the book has a footnote which reads, in 1954, the name of the Alcoholic Foundation Incorporated was changed to the General Service Board of Alcoholics Anonymous Incorporated, and the Foundation office is now the General Service Office. Returning to the text, neither its General Service Conference, its Foundation Board, nor the humblest group committee can issue a single directive to an AA member and make it stick, let alone mete out any punishment. We've tried it lots of times, but utter failure is always the result. Groups have tried to expel members, but the banished have come back to sit in the meeting place saying, this is life for us. You can't keep us out. Committees have instructed many an AA to stop working on a chronic backslider, only to be told, how I do my 12-step work is my business. Who are you to judge? This doesn't mean an AA won't take advice or suggestions from more experienced members, but he surely won't take orders. Who is more unpopular than the old-time AA, full of wisdom, who moves to another area and tries to tell the group there how to run its business? He and all like him, who view with alarm for the good of AA, meet the most stubborn resistance, or worse still, laughter. You might think AA's headquarters in New York would be an exception. Surely the people there would have to have some authority. But long ago, trustees and staff members alike found they could do no more than make suggestions and very mild ones at that. They even had to coin a couple of sentences which still go into half the letters they write. Of course, you are at perfect liberty to handle this matter any way you please. But the majority experience in AA does seem to suggest. Now, that attitude is far removed from central government, isn't it? We recognize that alcoholics can't be dictated to, individually or collectively. At this juncture, we can hear a churchman exclaim, "They are making disobedience a virtue." He is joined by a psychiatrist who says, "Defiant brats, they won't grow up and conform to social usage." The man in the street says, "I don't understand it. They must be nuts." But all these observers have overlooked something unique in Alcoholics Anonymous. Unless each AA member follows to the best of his ability our suggested 12 steps to recovery, he almost certainly signs his own death warrant. His drunkenness and dissolution are not penalties inflicted by people in authority. They result from his personal disobedience to spiritual principles. The same stern threat applies to the group itself. Unless there is approximate conformity to AA's 12 traditions, the group too can deteriorate and die. So we of AA do obey spiritual principles, first because we must, and ultimately because we love the kind of life such obedience brings. Great suffering and great love are AA's disciplinarians. We need no others. It is clear now that we ought never to name boards to govern us, but it is equally clear that we shall always need to authorize workers to serve us. It is the difference between the spirit of vested authority and the spirit of service, two concepts which are sometimes poles apart. It is in this spirit of service that we elect AA groups in formal rotating committee, the intergroup association for the area, and the general service conferences of Alcoholics Anonymous for AA as a whole. Even our foundation, once an independent board, is today directly accountable to our fellowship. Its trustees are the caretakers and expediters of our world services. Just as the aim of each AA member is personal sobriety, the aim of our services is to bring sobriety within reach of all who want it. If nobody does the group's chores, if the area's telephone rings unanswered, if we do not reply to our mail, then AA, as we know it, would stop. Our communications lines with those who need our help would be broken. AA has to function, but at the same time, it must avoid those dangers of great wealth, prestige, and entrenched power which necessarily tempt other societies. Though Tradition 9 at first sight seems to deal with a purely practical matter, in its actual operation, it discloses a society without organization, animated only by the spirit of service, a true fellowship. Tradition 10. Alcoholics Anonymous has no opinion on outside issues. Hence, the AA name ought never be drawn into public controversy. Never since it began has Alcoholics Anonymous been divided by a major controversial issue. Nor has our fellowship ever publicly taken sides on any question in an embattled world. This, however, has been no earned virtue. It could almost be said that we were born with it. For as one old-timer recently declared, practically never have I heard a heated religious, political, or reform argument among AA members. So long as we don't argue these matters privately, it's a sense we never shall publicly. As by some deep instinct, we AAs have known from the very beginning that we must never, no matter what the provocation, publicly take sides in any fight, even a worthy one. All history affords us a spectacle of striving nations and groups finally torn asunder because they were designed for or tempted into controversy. Others fell apart because of sheer self-righteousness while trying to enforce upon the rest of mankind some millennium of their own specification. In our own times, we have seen millions die in political and economic wars often spurred by religious and racial difference. We live in the imminent possibility of a fresh Holocaust to determine how men shall be governed and how the products of nature and toil shall be divided among them. That is the spiritual climate in which AA was born, and by God's grace has nevertheless flourished. Let us reemphasize that this reluctance to fight one another or anybody else is not counted as some special virtue which makes us feel superior to other people, nor does it mean that the members of Alcoholics Anonymous, now restored as citizens of the world, are going to back away from their individual responsibilities to act as they see the right upon issues of our time. But when it comes to AA as a whole, that's quite... because we know that our society will perish if it does. We conceive the survival and spread of Alcoholics Anonymous to be something of far greater importance than the weight we could collectively throw back of any other cause. Since recovery from alcoholism is life itself to us, it is imperative that we preserve in full strength our means of survival. Maybe this sounds as though the alcoholics in AA had suddenly gone peaceable and become one great big happy family. Of course, this isn't so at all. Human beings that we are, we squabble. Before we leveled off a bit, AA looked more like one prodigious squabble than anything else, at least on the surface. A corporation director who had just voted a company expenditure of $100,000 would appear at an AA business meeting and blow his top over an outlay of $25 worth of needed postage stamps. Disliking the attempt of some to manage a group, half its membership might angrily rush off to form another group, more to their liking. Elders, temporarily turned Pharisee, have sulked. Bitter attacks have been directed against people suspected of mixed motives. Despite their din, our puny rows never did AA a particle of harm. They were just part and parcel of learning to work and live together. Let it be noted, too, that they were almost always concerned with ways to make AA more effective, how to do the most good for the most alcoholics. The Washingtonian Society, a movement among alcoholics which started in Baltimore a century ago, almost discovered the answer to alcoholism. At first, the society was composed entirely of alcoholics trying to help one another. The early members foresaw that they should dedicate themselves to this sole aim. In many respects, the Washingtonians were akin to AA of today. Their membership passed the 100,000 mark. Had they been left to themselves, and had they stuck to their one goal, they might have found the rest of the answer. But this didn't happen. Instead, the Washingtonians permitted politicians and reformers, both alcoholic and non-alcoholic, to use the society for their own purposes. Abolition of slavery, for example, was a stormy political issue then. Soon, Washingtonian speakers violently and publicly took sides on this question. Maybe the society could have survived the abolition controversy, but it didn't have a chance from the moment it determined to reform America's drinking habits. When the Washingtonians became temperance crusaders, within a very few years, they had completely lost their effectiveness in helping alcoholics. The lesson to be learned from the Washingtonians was not overlooked by Alcoholics Anonymous. As we surveyed the wreck of that movement, early AA members resolved to keep our society out of public controversy. Thus was laid the cornerstone for Tradition 10. Alcoholics Anonymous has no opinion on outside issues. Hence, the AA name ought never be drawn into public controversy. Tradition 11. Our public relations policy is based on attraction rather than promotion. We need always maintain personal anonymity at the level of press, radio, and films. Without its legions of well-wishers, AA could never have grown as it has. Throughout the world, immense and favorable publicity of every description has been the principal means of bringing alcoholics into our fellowship. In AA offices, clubs, and homes, telephones ring constantly. One voice says, "I read a piece in the newspapers." Another, "We heard a radio program." And still another, "We saw a moving picture." Or, "We saw something about AA on television." It is no exaggeration to say that half of AA's membership has been led to us through channels like these. The inquiring voices are not all alcoholics or their families. Doctors read medical papers about Alcoholics Anonymous and call for more information. Clergymen see articles in their church journals and also make inquiries. Employers learn that great corporations have set their approval upon us and wish to discover what can be done about alcoholism in their own firms. Therefore, a great responsibility fell upon us to develop the best possible public relations policy for Alcoholics Anonymous. Through many painful experiences, we think we have arrived at what that policy ought to be. It is the opposite, in many ways, of usual promotional practice. We found that we had to rely upon the principle of attraction rather than of promotion. Let's see how these two contrasting ideas, attraction and promotion, work out. A political party wishes to win an election, so it advertises the virtues of its leadership to draw votes. A worthy charity wants to raise money. Forthwith, its letterhead shows the name of every distinguished person whose support can be obtained. Much of the political, economic, and religious life of the world is dependent upon publicized leadership. People who symbolize causes and ideas fill a deep human need. We of AA do not question that. But we do have to soberly face the fact that being in the public eye is hazardous, especially for us. By temperament, nearly every one of us had been an irrepressible promoter, and the prospect of a society composed almost entirely of promoters was frightening. Considering this explosive factor, we knew we had to exercise self-restraint. The way this restraint paid off was startling. It resulted in more favorable publicity of Alcoholics Anonymous than could possibly have been obtained through all the arts and abilities of AA's best press agents. Obviously, AA had to be publicized somehow, so we resorted to the idea that it would be far better to let our friends do this for us. Precisely that has happened to an unbelievable extent. Veteran newsmen, trained doubters that they are, have gone all out to carry AA's message. To them, we are something more than the source of good stories. On almost every news front, the men and women of the press have attached themselves to us as friends. In the beginning, the press could not understand our refusal of all personal publicity. They were genuinely baffled by our insistence upon anonymity. Then they got the point. Here was something rare in the world, a society which said it wished to publicize its principles and its work, but not its individual members. The press was delighted with this attitude. Ever since, these friends have reported AA with an enthusiasm which the most ardent members would find hard to match. There was actually a time when the press of America thought the anonymity of AA was better for us than some of our own members did. At one point, about 100 of our society were breaking anonymity at the public level. With perfectly good intent, these folks declared that the principle of anonymity was horse and buggy stuff, something appropriate to AA's pioneering days. They were sure that AA could go faster and farther if it availed itself of modern publicity methods. AA, they pointed out, included many persons of local, national, or international fame. Provided they were willing, and many were, why shouldn't their membership be publicized, thereby encouraging others to join us? These were plausible arguments, but happily, our friends of the writing profession disagreed with them. The foundation, here the book has a footnote which reads, "In 1954, the name of the Alcoholic Foundation Incorporated was changed to the General Service Board of Alcoholics Anonymous Incorporated, and the Foundation office is now the General Service Office." Back to the text. The Foundation wrote letters to practically every news outlet in North America, setting forth our public relations policy of attraction rather than promotion, and emphasizing personal anonymity as AA's greatest protection. Since that time, editors and rewrite men have repeatedly deleted names and pictures of members from AA copy. Frequently, they have reminded ambitious individuals of AA's anonymity policy. They have even sacrificed good stories to this end. The force of their cooperation has certainly helped. Only a few AA members are left who deliberately break anonymity at the public level. This, in brief, is the process by which AA's Tradition 11 was constructed. To us, however, it represents far more than a sound public relations policy. It is more than a denial of self-seeking. This tradition is a constant and practical reminder that personal ambition has no place in AA. In it, each member becomes an active guardian of our fellowship.